I've entitled this week, "Give Us This Day Our Daily Bread," not only because it is the title of the study, but because I think that petition of the Lord's Prayer is a very helpful way to begin to unpack the fact that there are close connections between implications of our faith as Christians and some of the realities of economic life today. And so we've been looking at different aspects of that, emphasizing different words of the petition. And so today, tonight, we're especially looking at the phrase "daily bread." What I'm going to do in the first few minutes, therefore, is to lay out some understandings that I think are important for us as Christians to bring to the fore, given a lot of the controversy regarding the role of government today. Now, what I'm going to be sharing is especially stuff that comes from out of a Lutheran perspective. However, for those of you who aren't Lutheran, I think it's fair to say that most major denominations, be they Protestant or Catholic or Jewish for that matter, have some strong things to say about the role of government, particularly in providing for the needs of those who are the most vulnerable. So stick with me, even if some of this Luther and Lutheran reference may not connect with where you yourself are at. And I'd like to begin by reading a portion from Luther's Large Catechism. And this is really going to be the main way I'm going to try to unpack daily bread, because he does something very interesting with the explanation of what this fourth petition of the Lord's Prayer, what are the implications of it. So this is what he says in response to the question, what does daily bread entail? Quote, "Food and clothing and other necessities for the body, but also peace and concord in our daily business and in associations of every description. In short, everything that pertains to the regulation of our domestic and our civil or political affairs. For where these two relations are interfered with and prevented from functioning properly, there the necessities of life are also interfered with, and life itself cannot be maintained for any period of time. Indeed, says Luther, the greatest need of all is to pray for our civil authorities and the government, for chiefly through them does God provide us daily bread and the comforts of this life." I emphasize that last sentence. Actually, it goes on and has a lot more to say, but I'll stop at that particular place because I think those words of Luther are rather startling to us in 1996. The task force that's working on this study document, which includes people of very different perspectives, I can assure you that one of the people who's a very strong free market advocate said, "Well, can't we just get rid of Luther at that point?" In other words, he said, stop the quote, you know. I don't want to hear this positive role of government stuff from Luther. And the rest of the task force kind of convinced him that, no, we can't drop that particular sentence. But I think it suggests that within our own tradition as Lutherans, and I submit this is true for other traditions also, there is a very healthy respect for the necessary role of government. And therefore, I don't think it's by accident that a lot of religious denominations in this country have been raising their voices through the public policy advocacy work they do in Washington and in a number of state capitals in the last few years and recent months, because of some of the mean-spiritedness and the kind of let's get rid of government and let's get government out of this and out of that. Because it's not just to be politically correct, but it's because we're speaking out of our own tradition as Lutherans when we say, hey, you know, that's not how we understand the necessary, embracive, institutional lives of this world that become the means through which God works, the means through which God works so that, in fact, daily bread might be available for all people. Luther recognizes that a whole network of relationships is necessary for people's livelihood, or in other words, for them to receive daily bread. Production, government, families, occupations, finance and banking, agriculture, commerce, healthcare, and what we today refer to as the voluntary sector and civil society are all involved. Without the relationships and institutions necessary for personal flourishing, we could not survive. Daily bread is not earned by the efforts of individuals alone. And so, as we heard in that passage, Luther especially highlights the role of government. Now, obviously, he was talking about a whole different political understanding, a much different kind of government than we're talking about today. But I think the bottom line is that his understanding is that it is through government that conditions are provided so that daily bread can be produced and distributed. In the Augsburg Confession of our church, it states, quote, "Government was instituted and ordained by God for the sake of good order," unquote. Now, I want to at least be honest and say I think there's ways in which that kind of respect for the authority of government has also been problematic in our tradition as Lutherans, because I think it's led some Lutherans to say, well, therefore, whatever the government does is right, and certainly the horrendous legacy from Nazi Germany is, I think, evidence of the dangers that kind of blind obedience to the authority of government can lead. But I think here, I'm trying to get at it in a somewhat different way of saying there's also a healthy appreciation that government is important in the social fabric of our life together. Lutherans in this country, for example, have in their social statements viewed this as meaning government is called to establish justice, to protect and advance human rights, and to promote the general welfare of all. And so whatever the context, the kind of baseline understanding is that government plays a role in whether or not people's livelihood is or is not going to be realized. I want to bring in another dimension of how Luther and the early reformers viewed the matter of not just government, but how government works together with other initiatives, and especially initiatives that we today might think of in terms of our social ministry organizations and other social service efforts that occur within communities. One of the things that happened in the early church, and the book here that I would refer you to is a book by Carter Lindbergh called Beyond Charity, Reformation Initiatives for the Poor. It's a fairly recent book, and he has a very fresh look at what in fact happened in the Church of the Reformation in the 16th century, and suggests there's some very provocative models there. Certainly would dismiss any of the tendencies to say, oh, well, you know, all this welfare stuff and all this stuff that's been going on in the last 60 years, that's somehow an innovation with the New Deal. He would say, no, we as Lutherans, and this is true also in terms of some of the other reformers, need to look at what actually happened in the 16th century. And we find there that the church then ended up collecting and distributing a lot of material aid to those who were in need, taking very seriously the reformers' mandate to serve the need of the neighbor. Through hospitals, co-fraternities, and through such things as low-interest loans to help people get started. And I think that kind of carried over into what a lot of immigrants brought to this country as they faced economic challenges and established homes and institutions to aid people in need, and which became really the forerunners of our social ministry organizations. However, at the same time, they recognized that those efforts really fell short in the face of massive poverty and a growing fear or suspicion of those who are poor. Luther proposed that communities provide for the social welfare of their citizens rather than expecting that the needs of those without resources would be met through individual almsgiving. He would not certainly agree with certain political voices in our day that would say, well, yeah, government will cut back and you know, somehow churches, individual congregations will totally pick up the slack. I think some of us have seen the statistics that would say, well, for most of our small congregations, that may mean an increase of $200,000 in our budget. And, you know, kind of, well, let's get real. How possible, you know, is that, even though certainly efforts of churches are important, and I don't want to discount that. I think there's a real partnership that's necessary. But it's interesting because in one passage, according to Lindbergh, it's very clear that for Luther, there was an underlying conviction that the basic necessities of life should be met through government, and that government and all of us together should help, quote, so that no one need become a beggar. In other words, it wasn't just a matter of saying, well, you got to provide the handout or you've got to provide the services, but how do we, you know, address some of the underlying factors? Some of you who've read Luther are aware that at times he spoke out just vehemently against some of the economic practices of his day. And I think his analysis of saying, no, just, you know, we've got to get at some of the root causes, not that he used those words, but it was more than just saying, well, we have to provide a handout. We've got to say, what are the economic forces that need to be challenged so that, in fact, the needs of the poor can be provided for? A community's resources in the early writings of the Reformation were to be used for the benefit of those in need. For example, they talk about establishing a common chest, and therefore this pool of money that would enable even such things as loans to help people get established in an occupation. In other words, to enable people to have access to a means of earning their livelihood. And so through measures like that, 450 years ago at least, we see that in the writings of the Reformers, they laid some early groundwork for what became later coordination of church and public social welfare initiatives. Certainly seeing that there was a necessary partnership between how churches themselves might be involved and how the wider community, especially as expressed through government, might be involved. And I think, therefore, it's no surprise that at least in our Lutheran social ministry organizations, and I think for Catholic Charities it's comparable, well over half of the money they need to run comes from government sources. In some places like New York City, it's something like 95%. And so even though people in our day are saying, well, yeah, churches need to be more involved, I think there needs to be realism as to how much of the church-related institutions depend for their program funds on the resources that come through the government. Let me just finish with a few more things, and then we can do some reacting, questioning, challenging some of this, talking about how it relates to our own day. Here's another perspective on how Luther viewed particularly the needs of women and children in his day. It's from a book by Pam Courtois called, I think it's called Blessed Are the Poor, and its subtitle deals with women and family policy and some theological perspectives on that. She writes, in place of the ideal of self-sufficiency, Luther substituted an ethic of care. In response to the exploitation of women, children, and families, He developed a holistic anthropology, which led to a fundamental web of interpersonal and institutional relationships. He saw that we were intrinsically interrelated with one another, so that you can't talk about kind of autonomous individuals apart from the matrix of relationships that are constitutive of who they are. He valued domesticity, or the economic, sexual, procreative, and physical care of the household. He understood that care within the household is impeded or enabled by larger ecclesial and governmental practices. At the heart of his ethic of care was a renewed spirituality which was based on equity and generosity in all arenas of human life. Now, these kind of fundamental understandings of the role of government, and especially the role of government in meeting the needs of those in need, are also picked up and reflected in the legacy of social statements that we have in the ELCA, and these come from the Lutheran Church in America and the American Lutheran Church over especially the last 30 years or so. I say that because I think sometimes people say, well, why should the church speak out on these issues? Well, actually, we've got a long legacy of the church addressing these matters. This is the way one statement put it. Government appropriately guarantees all citizens equal opportunity for self-development and upholds the rights of those who, by reason of race, age, health, ability, or social standing, are at the margin of our economic and social system. All persons in society are entitled to that which is necessary to lead a healthful existence. And it goes on talking about how government is responsible for providing a basic floor of benefits at an adequate level for health and decency. It is to ensure that no one is forced to go hungry or homeless, and none are deprived of adequate medical care. And then in another statement, the public policy goals of employment, adequate income, decent housing, health maintenance and care, nutrition, and education are fundamental rights of every citizen. So let's just stop for a minute and reflect on what are the implications of that. What are your responses to those themes within our tradition, especially in light of current realities?
What was, in Luther's day, the issue of separation of church and state?
Well, certainly he was very dependent on the princes for the success of the Reformation. So you're right, there was not the same... certainly not the same separation of church and state as we understand it under the U.S. Constitution.
That's a balance of his writing. That's a fundamental driver in the balance of his writing. And
right.
I don't know the answer to the question.
Right, right. And that's why, as I said at one point, there's a lot of developments between the 16th century and the 20th century that, you know, given the time, we would have to give due attention to
it. But to legitimately apply the word as written in that time to today's situation, that element has to be explored thoroughly, because that was a driving force in what originated the writings and what they drove to, where they were going.
Paul?
My understanding is that it was two kingdoms, not separation of.
Right.
And that the two kingdoms were there to, each with responsibility, but were dependent on each other and worked together to accomplish the common good.
That's right. And both were activities of God.
Separation is another part of a different Reformation tradition,
right,
particularly the Zwinglists and the Anabaptists.
Right, right.
And then,
and I think that's the
tradition of Lutheranism through the Scandinavian countries, where my background is, has been a very unbalanced unity over time. Where today, most Lutherans in Norway don't go to church, except for Easter or marriage. And it's very unbalanced. And it's very unhealthy.
It's interesting that in Sweden, the Church of Sweden is about to become separate from, and I was the Archbishop of the Church of Sweden was in Chicago not too long ago, and they are very much rejoicing in that because, you know, again, church attendance, as we might measure it today, may still not look that great. But I think there is an upsurge of interest, and they are seeing some healthy things, even though they still will depend on the church tax. The church tax will still be there. The taxpayers will pay the money to support churches through the government. But it is, clearly there's governmental differences in how one plays that out. But at the same time, I would maintain that doesn't question the fundamental theological understanding that I think is there in our tradition, namely that through government there should be the assurance that the needs of all will somehow be met. And I mean, I think it's helpful that you brought in Scandinavia, because I think the Scandinavian countries, despite some of the admitted problems that they're having now because of their fairly generous welfare state kinds of policies, I think have in many ways embodied that. I think certainly Germany and other European countries too. And obviously there have been other influences on that, but I think that fundamental, you know, bottom line kind of understanding.
One of the real strong disciplines they're having to run into is the direct rationing of healthcare because of the aging population and advanced technology. And they don't have any choice. And it's a real challenge. Mm-hmm. You reach 55, you don't have an option to get a kidney transplant.
Well, I think I don't know the whole scene on all of that, but I think it does vary from country to country about how much the cutbacks are. Yeah. Other reactions to this in the face of what we hear regularly in the news and the kinds of other discussions we've been having in the village this week about.
Frankly, always amazes me when you get into a discussion with people who say, the government has gotten too involved in our lives and too intrusive, and it's developed into a sort of a dangerous point, that a lot of times those very people have benefited from those places where they don't realize that it was the government that instituted programs that they have benefited from. Mm-hmm. And we've lived in places where there's been a movement to not tap into funding that's available through the federal government to get, let's say, senior citizens programming in a community. And to me, it's always seemed very bizarre because the community then doesn't have available the things that they can't come up with those resources themselves. Mm-hmm. And if they don't tap into them, somebody else is going to. And so I don't know, I think there's a lack of understanding about what kinds of things have been instituted in partnership with other groups in society to provide for the needs of people. I can't understand how anyone would, like, for example, I'll give you an example. Here on Sunday at the open house, somebody was there who has taught in the Lutheran school system her whole teaching career, and her husband asked the director here at Holden about do they teach religious values and so forth in the school here. And she said, no, because this is a public school. This school here is a part of the Schlen public school system, and we teach it in the community as a whole. Well, have you ever thought about this being a parochial school? She said, no, because we would have to pay for everything. I mean, the public schools offer us the computers, the books, the teachers who teach here are paid by the school system. There would be no, she could see no value. It would just sort of mean that that's all you would be working at. And I think sometimes people don't think about all of the resources that do come our way through government programs.
I recall hearing 2 or 3 years ago, it's something like $200,000
to run
of taxpayer money that's put into the school. So yeah, you're talking about significant. And of course, a community like that, I think it does, a lot of people might raise some questions, but I think that's why they're very clear there of keeping that same. I want to pick up on the first part of what you were saying, Marianne, because I think it will move us into the second half of what I want to deal with. This, and we're going to do some stuff in small groups, because I think, you know, the question is, how do we as voters participate in saying now, how should things be done better or differently? And what I want to pick up on is the whole matter of entitlements. You know, the kind of government mandated fund. In other words, these are the things that are not appropriated every year and have to be voted on every year by Congress. But if you fall in a given category, you qualify. This, I try not to do it with a bunch of statistics, so these are approximate portions of the pie. And I don't have with me right now what the total amounts of each of these are. But proportionally, this much of the whole, in terms of entitlements, goes to Social Security. The second biggest proportion, which is about a third of the total circle, goes to Medicare and Medicaid. This amount here goes to unemployment compensation, veterans compensation, and agricultural price supports, two-thirds of which I'm told goes to the 18 largest farms. We talked the other day about the huge corporate farming kinds of operations. Many of them actually reap the benefits there. A tenth of the circle goes to pensions for retired civilian and military workers. And then one-tenth of the circle goes for all the other low-income programs. Now, obviously, Medicaid also, in terms of the health care for low-income people, there's also some covered there. But one-tenth goes for the SSI payments, for AFDC, for food stamps, and for the earned income tax credit. So it's, I think, an important kind of thing when people say, well, let's just cut the entitlements. When you begin to, and there's another ladder kind of thing I could have put up here that really talks about what proportion of the population benefits from entitlements that they receive from the government. And it's, you know, by far the vast majority of those go to those of us who are middle or upper middle class. And so the whole notion that, well, we're giving all these entitlements to people who are poor is statistically simply not the case. Yeah.
I think the thing I have the most difficulty with is the tremendous waste. We watched, it was 2020, maybe 6 or 8 months ago, and they were talking about Medicare and Medicaid, and the fact that, and Tom Harkin, who happens to be a senator from Iowa, was one that tried to put a bill through to change it, where, and as an example, if you or I walked into Kmart and bought a blood pressure machine, we would pay $59 for it. Medicare, Medicaid will allow $350 for it. It's the same thing. A woman that has, not just a woman, somebody has to have a back brace. You can go to a prosthesis place and have a brace made and it might cost $350. Medicare, Medicaid will allow $900 for it. That is the tremendous, tremendous waste that I think needs to be eliminated, and it needs to be realistic. Pay for what is, but Tom Harkin was trying to get that, you know, and they voted it down. This was something that was set up years ago, and they just, it was kind of a slough thing. They raised it so high to cover any increases, and look how high it still is. I mean, it's obviously there's a lot of slough.
Of course, that's true. Other places in the government would be my point. You know, the big expose that occurred now, I don't remember how many years ago now, about how the Department of Defense paid $350 for a hammer or whatever. I think that kind of advantage is taken throughout. I'm not disputing what you're saying. I agree with you. There's a tremendous amount of waste in there, but the biggest part of the waste isn't really in this, even in this program. It's other places in the government's budget that the same kind of thing is happening in a larger proportion.
Yeah, I don't want to lose. I think the important point, you know, overall point you're bringing into the conversation here, because I think as we talk about the changing role of government and recognizing that the government is changing in 1996 as it hasn't changed for 60 some years. I mean, we're talking about major, major shifts. I mean, not just in terms of pullback of entitlements, but how much is shifting to states and localities, and the incredible pressure that more and more localities are going to face as to, well, what do we do with the poor people, about the poor people in our midst? There was a, I mentioned this the other day, there was a very alarming quote by a member of Congress from Ohio, I won't say his name, but who blasted the governor of New York, who is desperate, saying, in light of this new welfare reform that's just passed, what are we going to do in New York State, and particularly in New York City, seeing that in New York there is a constitutional mandate that the government will take care of the basic needs of
people. And they haven't got the money.
You know, and he said, you know, help.
It's not there.
And this member of Congress said, well, I just told the government he should change his constitution. Get rid of that. You know, I mean, that's the kind of radical surgery we're talking about here.
And that's just the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah.
Our government will be out of business in the year 2010 if they don't fundamentally change the issue of spending more than they take in. And that's the bottom line.
I think
line
it's going to be before then.
Yeah.
Well, the,
yeah,
the issue, let's get into that a little bit. Actually, I was going to have us do an exercise and think about how we might portion this differently, because I think there's some very real, if we just take the entitlement pie, now obviously there's a lot of other stuff, you know, on defense and, you know, and paying the deficit and those sorts of things. But if we just looked at this, there's a lot of ethical tensions here, especially when we recognize how big a portion of this goes to those who are over the age of 65. So I think I'm not primarily an economist and don't know all these budget discussions that well, so if some of you are, feel free to correct me. But I think the economists that I've been informed by have persuaded me that we are going to be facing a major, major crisis. You know, deficit has gotten a little better, and you know, there's been some good news lately about that. But we're looking at this huge bulge, and I was looking up the statistics this afternoon. The prediction, according to the Office of Budget and Management, is that unless there are significant changes in how we go about this, and as well as how we pay for them, under the current situation, people born from 1995 on will, over their lifetime, be paying about 85% of their lifetime income in taxes because of that huge amount of, quite frankly, paying for Social Security, et cetera, for people like myself when we get to that retirement age. And so, even though the deficit situation is a little better now, we're looking at, I think, huge questions here about how do we balance off some of the intergenerational equity kinds of issues. That doesn't mean somehow we should get rid of Social Security, but how do we deal with some conflicting ethical principles? Because I think plenty of us, you know, were raised with the understanding, well, you know, I pay into Social Security and I deserve what I get, and that's, you know, and yet then we're dealing with the needs of, you know, the increasing upsurge in poverty, as some of the figures that Jack was sharing this week indicate. And I think there's going to be lots of really tough questions that I hope we as church folk can be grappling with. And I think it becomes especially relevant seeing that many of our congregations have a large percentage of people who do fit in the 65 or older category. How do we deal with those tough questions?
You know, one of the problems, it seems to me that much of this word government has referred to large central government.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the problems that happens when central government gets so large is that we lose the face of the government. In other words, we don't know who the government is.
Mm-hmm.
And we also lose the face of those whom we are helping. So that most of us don't see the poor. Mm-hmm. We pay our taxes and we assume that it's taken care of, but we don't experience the helping of the poor. On the other side of the fence, the government loses its account. They are no longer accountable to us. As congregational members, don't we get a layout on paper every year of what's been taken in and where it's gone? We don't get that from our federal government. And
not unless
we want to. Well, they haven't had an allowance budget since the 60s.
Right.
So they have no idea what's going on. I mean, literally, they don't.
Well, in the 60s happened to be when Medicare, Medicaid originated. And if you want to talk about fat and Medicare, Medicaid, I can talk forever on it because I've been involved with it.
Well,
it's
sure,
getting leaner because
healthcare
is changing. Mm-hmm. Healthcare is changing drastically. But part of the issue is what are our rights? You know, for the last 30 years, we've had the right to have an ambulance race around to the bottom of a cliff and pick us up when we fell off. We didn't have any responsibility for finding the road at the top of the cliff to stay off of falling off it. We could smoke all we wanted, we could drink all we wanted, we could get sick from food we ate inappropriately, all we wanted to. And overnight, the government has said, wait a minute, we can't afford to pick you up at the bottom of the cliff anymore. You people are going to have to suffer the transition time while we straighten the road out at the top and get out of health care as much as we can, because we can't afford it anymore. So they fundamentally changed Medicare and Medicaid. They're providing tax-deductible opportunities for self-insuring for long-term care, because the growth of Medicaid with the fastest-growing population 85 and older is not going to stop. Medicaid is going to just skyrocket, because nobody's saving for tomorrow. Everybody has a right to Medicaid, and everybody has a right to Social Security. Neither of which were ever designed to provide health care or retirement living for everybody.
At the rate it's going, it's going to bankrupt the whole country.
And yet,
and
we as a population are sucked into a process of not taking responsibility for ourselves.
Yeah, I think you're raising a really important point there, and that many people are saying, how do we talk about the necessary connection between rights and responsibilities? Mm-hmm. And how that gets engendered over the long haul. I mean, when you're dealing with somebody in desperate need to say, well, you know, I'm going to preach a sermon on responsibility, that's probably not the appropriate time. No. But, you know, how do we rebuild that? And I think I'm impressed by how many social commentators today, I think, are coming up with similar assessments. You know, how do we rebuild that social fabric? Really talk about the development of virtue and values, again, conversations from earlier this week, and important stuff that, if left not tended to, results in the kind of, not just the kind of, well, I want my right, but I'm going to sue you if you do something to me, and all of the kind of individual rights and kind of to hell with everybody else kind of thing that
One of the real tough credibility issues for big government in this country is the lack of credibility it's established for itself in running programs like these. Mm-hmm. It made rules to the point where I was licensed as a nursing home administrator. If I enforced the law 100% correctly, I'd face 6 felons.
But the government doesn't itself.
Well, the conflict in laws between state
rules,
and federal. I faced 6 felonies, however I administered the facility, if the wrong circumstances happened. And there was no way I could get out of that in that position. So I got out of it by becoming a consultant.
One of the other areas that we try to get into in this document is that whole matter. In fact, first issue is regulation. Because I think there's a lot of serious questions that need to be raised there. And how, you know, is it possible to rethink some of these regulations to say, yeah, there's an important goal at stake here, but how do we develop some flexibility? Because there's an incredible number of bizarre cases.
And that has been going already for the last 7 years. It took 6 years to get a reform law for Medicaid nursing home law enacted. And so that's going on.
Paul? If others want to get in, just raise your hand.
One of the responses I can make, that I've been around long enough to remember how Medicare came into being, and also all of the other entitlement programs, everything from daycare or whatever that went through, the regulations are not there because the government felt some bizarre need to regulate our lives. It was because people were saying, how can we be sure that the folks in the state of Washington won't cheat and make us Iowans pay more money? Yeah. And so they put in incredibly difficult standards to meet because what I would call mean-spirited people didn't want the programs in the first place, and as a result wanted to make it as difficult as possible for anyone to abuse the program. I remember back in the early 70s when one politician that proposed that we simply drop all the standards. Because we would save so much money that's being spent enforcing standards, most of which were unreasonably difficult anyway, that if we had no standards and went on a pure trust system, our government could operate at a fraction of its cost. Of course, he was laughed at for obvious reasons. We don't trust anybody beyond our neighborhood to administer it. I also remember the reason the federal government assumed this role. And that was because community after community said, we can't generate enough income in our community. We have to go, it's easier to generate tax monies at a national level because a congressman and a senator is farther removed from the voter. And that's the sole reason the government got in this. And also, I shouldn't say the sole, the second reason was, if Iowa took its job seriously and was doing a good job, then all the folks from Missouri wanted to move there and take advantage of it. So in an attempt to equalize benefits, we look to the federal government.
And in fact,
but I think that's the fear of what's going to happen with all the block granting that's going to occur under this. And how will the states be in competition?
But in fact, that didn't occur. It didn't resolve that issue. There was a Medicaid, there exists to this day, a Medicaid slide of people coming from the South moving right up to the center of the Midwest to more attractive Medicaid benefits. Just moving. And I can't tell you how many employees I had at a nursing home in Wisconsin who would take the summer off or get fired or quit and go to Chicago and get pregnant and then come back to get employment so they could increase their AFDC benefits. But they wouldn't work any hours over and above the minimum required, because if you fire them, then they would get other benefits.
Mm-hmm. Somebody else over here is trying. Yeah.
With that particular argument, I sort of have a problem because I can't imagine too many women who would be thinking that they're going to come out ahead financially.
Oh, but they do. They do. If they have one more baby, they get X more benefits. And that's all they see. They don't see how much it's going to cost them. All they see is how much more dollars they're going to get.
But what percentage of the employees really do that? I mean, is there a significant...
And that's the other dilemma. When we're entitled to Medicaid reimbursement for a nursing home, we compete with McDonald's across the street, and they beat us on wage every time.
It's frightening to think that our senior citizens are being cared for by people by such limited intelligence.
And in all but one or two states in this country, the prisoners in the prisons have more rights and entitlements than the residents in the nursing home. They have free cable television that they have a right to. They have all the exercise equipment brand new that they have a right to.
That's not.
I think you were you trying to get in a while ago, or is it passed? Okay. Let's think a little bit more, and we'll do it collectively, all together rather than in some small groups. If you had the power to tell Congress how this pie should be cut differently, how would you do it? What would get bigger?
You better start with available resources first.
Okay. So you're wanting to look at the tax, the revenue.
You can't spend more than you take in. That can't be done.
Well, it can because we do it, but...
Definitely.
We've been doing it for quite
a
while.
Yes, but and your the problem is all of our revenue now is going to pay the interest on the debt.
Yeah.
We're not going to have any entitlements.
That's right. But where did the deficit come from? I mean, that's another
question. Well, it's there.
Question.
That's reality. And
in Jack's session, we talked about this too. The Social Security problem is not just who's getting it, but the fact that how it's funded. I mean, when people who are wealthy do not pay on their investment income, only on their wages, you have a tremendous amount of money that should be going into Social Security that isn't. I mean, I don't
That's not how Social Security was ever set up.
I'm not talking about how it's set up. I'm talking about how it's run now.
But what you're talking about is not dealing with Social Security as it was ever designed.
Well, that's not the point, though.
Here's the point.
The point is the way it is operating now, whether it was the way it was designed to operate or not,
It's underfunded, the way it operates, reality, the way it is done, not the way it was designed, because the people who should be paying for their, all their income into it.
I agree with you to that point. And to that point, there's a solution. And that solution is means testing for eligibility. That solves both problems real early. Because I have a client who's 91 years old, who earns $55,000 a year in Social Security, and doesn't want it, and doesn't need it, but can't stop it.
Why?
She can't stop it.
You can't stop Social Security.
You can't stop Social Security.
You can always give it back.
She was eligible for she started in Social Security paying before you did. She didn't have to start taking it until she was 85. So she can't stop it.
Let's hear from some others as to the your experiences and perspectives in terms of the role of government. I mean, I think that the concerns have been registered about the efficiency, the effectiveness, and especially how programs that were designed to do some other things are now being evaluated by whether they do this. And I think, again, Jack mentioned that this morning, of, you know, AFDC was never designed to lift people out of poverty, just to help make things a little bit more bearable. Other places where you see some real tensions in terms of role of government. Yeah.
Well, I can't think about that. I was going to say something else.
Well, go ahead. I live in Canada, and while we don't have a perfect system, I think that it's more fair, and that it's not dependent on income or on status or who you know for your right to health care. And I really strongly feel, I'm an American because I was born in North Dakota, but I strongly feel that North Americans have to look at redesigning the whole thing. And I know Hillary tried and that got kind of pushed aside and whatever. But it's going to be, it seems to be going more an income separate, like the class thing is going to rule, and the separation of the classes is much more significant than it was just even a few years ago. So the people that can afford the insurance down here and the ones that can't, it's widening, isn't it? I mean,
well, yeah, there are more uninsured people every year.
Yeah, and I just think that that's terrible, and I'm sure most of you do as well. But and I'm not saying that Canada has the only answer, but the Scandinavian countries seem to have at least some kind, and the British system seems to at least be a little more fair. And I think the other thing that I observed from some of my friends down here who are doctors, and I've tried to talk to them, and they're really scared that if the government got involved, that the quality of health care, and I'm going, well, the quality of health care in Canada is fine. I don't have a problem. Of course, I'm not very ill. But I don't have a problem with, I've never had to pay for anything. I do pay for my prescriptions if I need one. But the only stories that you tend to hear are the real drastic ones. So if you guys hear the Canadian that has to go to Seattle to have surgery, that's not, you know, it may be somewhat common. I don't know if there's any other Canadians here. But I don't think that we need to throw it all out because the quality of health care in America might suffer. I think it's pretty good. But I don't think that it would just, would all the doctors quit being doctors if they had to,
we wouldn't have as many other things because their income is enormously higher than any one of the socialized states.
And yet, it's real interesting to see the financials of a good number of physicians. Their net worth is probably less than yours. I have 24 physicians as clients in financial practice. And I happen to work with a significant number who don't know the first thing about dollars. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the first thing I do with them is trying to build them into a net worth that's positive.
But is that what it's about? Is that what the reason they're a doctor is so they can make money?
No, no, but it's to make a livable wage and provide a service. And they work 80 hours a week.
Exactly. What is a livable wage and why do they...
But for them in their situation, the cost of the business that they're in, they're trapped. They're stuck. They're not happy. They're working 80 hours a week and having a family, and they're not happy at all because they don't have any time for their family, and they have to keep working to pay the debt they've incurred to get the education they have, to practice the profession they have. They're stuck. And okay, they're some of the most unhappy people I know.
Yeah. I don't understand. Because I know a lot of them too, and they, for some reason in our town, they buy up all the best homes.
I agree. The ones I deal with are the exception and not the rule.
Yeah.
I would like to address kind of this. I have a stepson that is a trauma surgeon, and he's been at a county hospital in Fresno, California. And I think this is a trend, and you probably are a lot more familiar with this than I am, but I think this is a trend that we're going to start seeing. Mm-hmm. That county hospital has been bought by private individuals. Mm-hmm. And my stepson is looking for a new position because the quality, I mean, think about the trauma department in a huge county hospital. Mm-hmm. 95% of their patients do not have insurance, and yet they get quality care. Well, now here, this is being bought by private individuals, and they're going to, the trauma department is going to go down the tube because it's not going to make any money for them. Mm-hmm. And that's why my stepson is looking. He's got his resume out, looking to move somewhere else. But I think what's going to happen is that this trend for the county hospitals to be bought by private individuals is going to run the country. And I'm certain, like my own stepson, is probably going to wind up going into just being a surgeon, just going in and being in private practice and being a general surgeon. I think the quality of trauma is just going to go.
Well, the privatization, not just in terms of hospitals, but in a lot of other sectors of whether it's collecting garbage or...
Is the purpose of healthcare and of all these other areas profit-making? Or should it be a service and therefore a right for citizens of a country?
The hidden thing in American healthcare is the right we as citizens have for research and development and education of specialists that we've never paid for. It's a hidden right that's been grown overblown, entitling all of us to all this extravagant health care that we've never had to pay the bill for. You know where it's come from? Medicare, federal grants, private insurance companies, but it's disappearing overnight. And we have a fundamental health crisis in this country, more from the issue of technological change in health care than from anything else. The capital cost of technology in healthcare is huge, but the benefit is phenomenal. I know a 104-year-old woman who had both hips replaced and walked in a nursing home for 3 years before she died. And the issue was quality of life. And it was a wonderful solution to dying laying in bed. Now, she wasn't productive in society to pay for that, but I can tell you example after example of that same thing. And one of the core elements about this is we have a society that denies death at every cost, and yet in the last 6 months of life, the Medicare bill, for the last 6 months a year of life, every year for the last 10 years, has been $150 million with 10% growth every year. For the last 10 years, the outcome has always still been the same. Because it's always been...
So you think we should deny people the last...
That's the ethical dilemma our society has to face.
Well, and that we may have to face ourselves. I mean, as we get closer to that, just like, am I going to pursue it? I mean, I'm going to die eventually. Yeah. You know, and next year may not be comfortable for me, but... it's going to happen.
The reality for lots of people in terminal illness today is if they can find a means technologically to assist them to survive for another 12 months, they might be cured. And the lucky ones get there and the unlucky ones don't.
Yeah, but this is what I think I've said that before. In this country, we're really not allowed to die anymore.
Mm-hmm. And that's a real problem.
Yeah. How long do you want to keep us alive?
That's a real problem.
The other side of the coin is, how much could we do if we were, if we had universal health care in some form, how much better could we do at preventative health care than we do now? We are lousy, I mean totally lousy, in preventative health care. People don't go to the doctor regularly if they don't have insurance because they cannot afford to. Therefore, we have people more seriously ill when they finally do get taken care of. And I think that whole area of investing some of this money in prevention as opposed to having to spend so much more when it comes to...
And that's exactly the transition that medical reimbursement for health care is getting to. With managed care, which is not a real comfortable issue for a lot of people.
And how are you going to deal with the one who has been counseled and told and taught what to do to maintain a better lifestyle and says, I don't want to do that. I've had my bypass surgery and I'm going to eat my eggs and drink my whole milk and have cream on my cereal and I don't care. And if my vessels get clogged up again, I'll come in and have surgery again.
Blow it on.
Okay. Now who's going to pay for that? Because somebody's too stubborn to change their behavior to help them live more healthily.
So it's a kind of rights and responsibilities
right.
kind of combination right. there again.
You can take that even one step further, and that I understand that the greatest increase in the health of the world, or the population, whatever, came by advances in clean water mm-hmm. and proper nutrition, not by any of the technology that we've got going now. You know, and why can't we have that in the world? Mm-hmm. Why can't our children just have the nutrition they need to start out healthy? And that's a big question.
It is, I think.
Because probably doesn't have commercials.
Yeah, that might be one of the things that evolves from the global economy. It's better distribution of resources.
I think one way to help with some of this is to keep some measure of responsibility on individual people. If you buy a private health insurance policy, it almost always has a deductible and co-insurance on it. And maybe the government programs have to work exactly mm-hmm. the same way so that if you have your bypass and then think about pouring cream on your cereal, you realize that you will have to pay a fair amount of money for your next bypass.
Well, in fact, one of the other things that's already being done, the government just passed a bill to raise the deductibility of self-insurance premiums. Having sold insurance for years, it's phenomenally hard to get healthy people who don't have group health insurance to buy individual insurance. I'm not going to get sick. I don't want it. I don't need it. It's also phenomenally difficult to sell people private long-term care insurance. But at the age of 65, they're 15 times more likely to have their home burned down than they are they're 15 times more likely to go into a nursing home than have their home burned down. But they'll never drop their homeowner's insurance, even though it's paid for. And so there's not a lot of logic to consumers' approach a lot.
One last comment, then we'll try and
turn. It seems also, though, that we're going on a lot of assumptions in this discussion that mm-hmm. everyone has the ability to save enough to pay mm-hmm. huge deductibles, mm-hmm. sometimes many thousands of dollars in just the deductible. And a lot of people simply don't have the money to monthly pay out for a policy and save the money for a $2,000 deductible. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thank
that's
you.
True.
Yeah.
That's very true.
Not only that, and I would also add the other thing that's been prevalent, I think, in our discussion, and in that sense, I think it's typical of what goes on in much of the public discussion of these issues, is the anecdotal mm-hmm. of, you know, we can always point to examples where there really are inefficiencies, and yet overlook the way in which many of these programs have, in fact, been fairly effective in helping people. Maybe not that effective in pulling people out of poverty, but have at least kept more people from becoming more poor, which is itself not a minor kind of accomplishment. We the man over here mentioned the importance of the taxation issue, which obviously we didn't get into today, but I think there that too is an important kind of issue. And let me just close with this paragraph. We as a church cannot presume to have quick and easy answers to this huge complex challenge, but I think we began to get into a little bit, and I would say give some more attention to what you would shift in that particular pie. But I would submit that the benchmark of sufficient sustainable livelihood for all, and we're going to be getting more into the dynamics of what that means in my final thing tomorrow evening, needs to be brought to bear in public policy discussions. For some people, cutbacks in certain entitlements will not threaten the sufficiency of their livelihood. But for others, the effects on their livelihood and well-being will be severe. Similarly, higher taxes will threaten the sufficiency of some people's livelihoods, but not of others. And how do we, as people of faith, involve ourselves in those public discussions where some issues, some difficult, controversial aspects of this come to the fore? I think some of that began to come out here. But realize that for us as people of faith, the bottom line is that fundamental theological understanding that it is God's intention that the basic needs of all be met. And how in fact can that happen? Not just by turning it either over to government or over to this group or that, but through these interconnected relationships through which daily bread is made available for the sake of all. Thank you for your lively discussion.